that it's over, but my head's not going under, and I'm not, and my head's not going under, but I'm still sad it's over, and I'm not.
This is DJ Hoodie from The Music Box, and yep, it's that time of year where we want your money, we need your support, so yeah, donate what you can. When I first arrived in Canada, CITR was the only radio station that provided quality alternative programming away from the boring mainstream radio. I'd be tuned into shows like African Rhythms and The Rockers Show that still exist today. And now CITR has given me the opportunity to host my own show with no boundaries, so I can share my music collection freely with listeners. So, yeah, please give what you can. We need your support so we can keep this great station alive. So go to citr.ca/donate.
Hello, happy Friday morning. You are listening to CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia on the unceded and stolen Musqueam territory. My name is Ruby Raven, and this is not my first Schmodio. Welcome. So this week has been Fun Drive at the radio station. Fun Drive is our weekly fundraising campaign that we do every single year. This year we are trying to raise $20,000 for a new radio transmitter, something that is incredibly integral to the transmission of radio. Ours has been around since the 70s on the top of Gage Tower on UBC campus, and it's holding it together, but, you know, I think it's ready to retire, and we really need a new one. Yesterday, Fun Drive actually ended, but today we're still taking donations. We're still, you know, we want things to be trickling in. And so if you have anything, $5, $1 million, anything, $20,000, whatever it is, we will take it. I just quickly want to say I love CITR so, so much. It's such an amazing place on campus for just real community. It's incredibly accessible, so we really want everyone to come and to be able to talk about what they want to talk about, create the work that they want to create. And I found it to be an incredibly welcoming place, you know, especially something that can be so intimidating like radio. Everyone here is truly so eager to help you do what you want to do. And I think the amazing thing is everyone loves it so much. So there's such a fun, positive, passionate culture here. And I also think it has such an important place in the arts and culture scene in the city. It's not too big in Vancouver, but CITR has been around for a really long time. And with partnered with our magazine Discorder, I think we are a really important, CITR is a really important fixture in the city. So please donate if you can, citr.ca/donate. We are trying to get a new radio transmitter, please. Okay, so now back to the show, Not My First Schmodio. This is the first episode of the second season of Not My First Schmodio. And because it's Fun Drive, we're doing these special episodes this week. So my special episode, I decided, is going to be Oscar themed. So this episode's a little convoluted. I'm going to take you through it quickly before we get started. So it's Fun Drive. It's the first episode of the second season. And what I've decided to do is Oscar theme. So there you're going to hear three interviews, one with Oscar nominee Dean Fleischer Camp that I conducted in September for the Vancouver International Film Festival. So I'm airing it now. He wasn't nominated for an Oscar then, but he is now. And it goes with my theme. So there you go. The second interview is, bear with me here. So my favorite person ever to have won an Oscar is Jane Fonda. And the person I'm interviewing is a comedian who acted with her on a show called Grace and Frankie for 7 years. So I am now 1 degree removed from Jane Fonda. Okay, so this is a big deal for me. So that's how this interview makes sense within the theme. It makes total sense. He worked with my favorite person ever to win an Oscar. And then the third interview is with the very famous, my Uncle Jake. He was kind enough to share a schmoment with me. I decided to give him Oscar for best schmoment. I'm really lucky that having this show, when I tell people what it is, they oftentimes will share their schmoments with me, their embarrassing moments, which I hold as so sacred. But and his was one of my favorites, not the number one favorite, because I have a lot of favorites, but his was one that I really liked, and it really felt like this is what a schmoment is all about. So that is how it relates to the Oscars. It's Oscars for best schmoment. Okay, amazing. So my first interview is with Dean. Oh my God, I forgot to say. So my second interview with Baron Vaughn, it was his name. I think I forgot to say it. He is a part of the Vancouver Just for Laughs Comedy Festival that is happening in February. So I'm going to be interviewing a ton of comedians this season on Not My First Schmodio in partnership with Just for Laughs. So I'm really excited about that because I've already interviewed a few and they're so funny and they're so smart, and I can't wait to go to a million shows while the festival is here from February 16th to the 25th. Okay, well, without further ado, let's begin the Dean Fleischer Camp interview on the first episode of the second season of Not My First Schmodio, a special fun drive episode Oscars themed. Oh my God, I need to explain another thing. Okay, so when I did this interview, because Dean Fleischer Camp is kind of a, you know, he's kind of a hotshot, he has an assistant. And before he came on the Zoom call during our interview, his assistant was on the call. And I ended up talking with the assistant for a little while before Dean came on. And when Dean popped on, the assistant and I were in the middle of a conversation that Dean later joined. So the interview starts in the middle of a conversation that Dean later joins. It'll make sense after a few moments, but it's a little abrupt, so I just wanted to give everyone fair warning. Okay, here we go. Okay, now here we go.
The nerd thing.
Hi. Go ahead.
To be continued.
What's the nerd thing?
Well, we're ready to nerd out about Marcel and anything to be discussed.
I was just talking to Sam about when he first moved to LA. I was asking him if he did any like film comedy nerd thing.
Oh, yeah.
And he was telling me about just the thesis that he wrote. But you're leaving me on a cliffhanger. What was the nerd thing?
I'm going to grab something. You can
go ahead. Yeah.
I was going down a different path. A shorter nerd thing is, I was really curious to find, if you've seen the movie Drive, there is a section where Ryan Gosling decides to take, Michelle Williams, I think, into the LA River and comes across like a jungle in the middle of the LA River, which I thought was kind of preposterous. And so when I first came to LA, while I was still in college, I sought that out and I found the spot, and it exists. It's real.
Oh my God.
They happen to shoot around the like, you know, overturned shopping cart and the trash around there and made it look much more beautiful. But but it really exists.
You were so bothered by this preposterous scene
that
the first thing you did when you came to LA was seek out this river.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
All right. Really, that is the right hole in the fence. I got my nerd thing. Thank you.
One of the first things I did when I moved to New York for college was set out the apartment where like the final shootout in Taxi Driver takes place.
That is very fair. I'm sure you weren't the first.
Yeah, totally. I know. I found it. I was like, I bet there's like a couple weirdos a year that come to look for this place. And probably the people that live there are like, what is that guy doing?
That's how you know you're like a real cinephile, is if you're like creeping out the neighbors.
Right. Are you a comedy film dork yourself, Ruby? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, I'm like sketch, improv, comedy nerd person. So that's what I was interested in asking Sam about. Yeah. And that's why I'm so interested in you and Marcel. Great segue.
Yeah, nice. Really professional.
Thank you so much. All right. So on October 7th, between 1 and 2 p.m., you'll be joining the VIF Connect talk. So you're joining VIF to talk about your hit film, Marcel the Shell with Shoes On, which I saw over the summer and I really loved, you know, for a variety of reasons. I'm a huge Jenny Slate fan. Now I'm a huge you fan. but I really loved that Marcel was never the butt of the joke, that like you took his emotional world really, really seriously and you like dealt with it with a lot of respect. But also the premise of him being this shell that talks and wears shoes is like preposterous. That's where like the comedy comes in. So, but I love just how heartfelt it was and how serious the audience was allowed to take his story, even though it was a ridiculous story.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, yeah, I always like what I always loved about the shorts and what I was really trying to maintain with the feature was like that contrast, because something that I always thought Marcel's a real living individual, and I didn't want I don't even like the term mockumentary, because I think it implies that you're mocking the subject or mocking documentaries. And I had never really seen a movie where it's a mockumentary, but the subject is treated with just as much dignity as like, you know, Grey Gardens or any real documentary subject.
Also, Grey Gardens is constantly being made fun of, so I love that was the example that you used. But no, that's such a great word, because that's how I felt about Marcel, that he had such dignity. So that's the perfect word. And a lot of what you write is what I would describe as perhaps off-kilter. I really love Catherine. so I'm wondering that, if when you were a young writer, were you like, I want to write like the most unique thing no one's ever seen before? Or were your first ideas always like very weird and different?
Wow, what a good question. I guess I don't see them as weird. I think it's maybe the issue. I think we're all, whatever your work is sort of a, it's a document of your enthusiasms at that moment, or your reaction to like, you know, whatever's going on in the zeitgeist or stuff you've been watching or stuff friends are making. And I know that Catherine, for example, was a reaction that Jenny and I had to sort of like, at the time it was like, there was like such a boom in online content and people were constantly asking us to like make video, asking me to direct a video, we'll give you like $2,000. Can you make us like 30 shorts? And it just felt like, oh no. And also I'm like, that level of output is so straining and I'm sick of being clever or whatever. And so, Jenny and I sort of started this silly experiment that made us laugh about like, oh, could we have a conversation that's just completely neutral and sincere? And then the tone of Catherine was like born first, and then we started making it this like office dramedy or whatever. But yeah, it came from feeling like there was nothing sincere out in the world and there was nothing kind of neutral out in the world, and everything's clever and sarcastic and cynical, and how do we make something that's like perfectly neutral?
So that's almost the I love that, because when I'm watching it, I'm like looking for meaning somewhere. I'm like, what is this? And like, what does this music mean? Or the ending, it was all about their friendship. Like, I'm looking so hard for some sort of like larger, meaningful.
Yeah, I think it's intended. I think it's intended to like the thing I was trying to do that I think is successful at times is to make the normal, familiar world feel really strange and unfamiliar. Mm-hmm. And then because it allows you to look at, you know, the strangeness of everyday existence from a different lens, from a perspective of like, you know, yeah, maybe my normal everyday job, this commute to work, they're all a little surreal and absurdist when you really like take a step back. And also I grew up in a family that was like very, I think we used sarcasm and like joking to hide our true emotions a lot. And so Catherine is also me maybe expressing or exercising this discomfort that I have with like someone looking me directly in the eye and being completely sincere, which to me is a horror movie.
Well, that's so interesting. I love what you said about like you rejecting being clever. And I also feel like with my question before about, were you trying to write something that was like so unique and so different? In trying to write like the most mundane, non-clever thing, that is the thing that's unique because it's not clever or not trying to be clever.
Yeah.
And I, you know, with Catherine or Marcel making these like weird, cool things that get recognized and that are successful in Hollywood, and, you know, success in Hollywood is like peak status. So you get praised all the time. And I always wanted to ask someone who has become popular in the mainstream, what is it like to be praised all the time?
That is so funny. I don't think I am praised all the time. I still see myself very much like an outsider of not just like Hollywood, but any sort of scene that I've been a part of or anything like that. I never totally feel like, oh, that's like my home. And maybe that is the reason I'm like kind of restless and always like making new types of projects. But I don't think that I am praised all the time. But I'm flattered that you think I'm praised all the time.
Well, I mean, your projects are so successful. So I imagine
also
that...
It's drowned out by like the torrent of self-hatred and denial that is actually... you know, running through my head all the time. So maybe that's why.
That's probably a pretty common trait of people who are praised all the time. So you probably don't notice the praise because you reject it.
Oh, I've definitely talked to people, and I have like, compared to, you know, actual like Hollywood success story people, I have like such a tiny, I've experienced such a tiny amount of public discourse around my work or myself or whatever. But people I know have said to me that it doesn't matter like how many positive reviews you get, you're just going to focus on that one internet comment or whatever that was like, this thing sucked. And so it sort of doesn't, but maybe you're right, maybe there is a benefit to, you know, not drinking the Kool-Aid about yourself and to sort of, I don't think self-hatred is healthy, but
I think there's a balance.
There's a balance.
There's a balance to strike somewhere. Maybe someone has struck it at some point. What I really love about following the story of the film is the collaboration that happens between you and Jenny and you and Nick Paley, your writing partner for the film. Because what I am always really drawn to in like the fandom around comedy is the friendship and the collaboration that happens. That's sort of what I crave. So what is it like to just collaborate with your friends? How great is it?
Oh, it's the best thing in the world. It's truly my favorite part of my job. It really, really rules. Can I curse?
Please.
It's recorded. You can bleep it out. Yeah, fucking rules. It's the best part of my job. And I think like the further you get into your career in entertainment, whatever it is, I think the more grateful you become when you do get those opportunities where you're like, I actually get to choose my co-writer for this or my co-star for this or whatever. Those are always the best projects and so much fun to work on. And yeah, I wouldn't have it any other way. It really is important.
And does compromise come into play in a big way especially when you're writing with people that you have these personal relationships with?
Yeah, totally. I mean, Nick and I collaborate on lots of stuff. We sometimes co-direct things. We've written a ton of things together, and we met at, you know, like 15 years ago in college. So we've got a pretty like fine-tuned sense of, you know, how to compromise, how to like work with one another. I think we used to get frustrated working together more often than we do now. But yeah, you have to, I mean, ultimately, in everything I've worked on, there's someone who is the primary, kind of, usually. Mm-hmm. So compromise, you know, if you really can't compromise, you can't find a compromise, it ultimately defaults to, like, whoever's going to have to be with the project long term. So even if I'm writing on a project of Nick's, it's like, I'm going to compromise on something I feel strongly about, because I'm like, but you're directing it. So like, you have to actually be able to give a full throated support of this idea. And even if I'm quote unquote right, that this is like a better or smarter or whatever thing, it won't matter because he's the person that's taking it across the finish line. So I think that's important to keep in your mind.
Right. Sometimes hierarchy just gets things done.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. And also it's a generous thing to be able to say, like, I think that's the right thing, but I'm going to put my ego over here because this is that person's project.
Yeah. Yeah. When you were a kid, were you like dying to be a filmmaker?
I didn't until probably like 15 or 16. I started getting really, really into film. Before that, I was mostly into drawing and painting and photography and stuff. And then I like had, my brother was a stand-up comic, is a stand-up comic. And so I sort of grew an interest in like performing. And I acted in some plays in high school and college. And then I had one disastrous production of Waiting for Godot that went awry. And I developed like tripling stage fright ever since then. So then I was like, I'm going to go behind the camera. And that's what I've been doing ever since.
What happened?
Did Godot
show up or something? Like,
right. It's ruined. That's so funny. If you know the play, you know that like the whole point is that he never comes, and there's this messenger boy who shows up at the end and is like, hey, Godot's not going to come, but he'll be here tomorrow. That's the end of the play. The boy, who was like an actual child who was like in the production or whatever, fell asleep backstage, and no one knew where, no one could find him. So I and my scene partner were just forced to like improvise in like Samuel Beckett speak for like 20 minutes, and nothing stopped it. And I kept waiting to be like, curtains are going to go down or lights will, like something. And it just never did. So and like the whole point of the play is they never leave the stage. Estragon and Vladimir never leave the stage. And then finally, I think I was just like, want to go get a bite? And then my scene partner was like, yeah, cool. That was the end of it. That was the end of that production of Waiting for Godot.
Oh my God. So I have my radio show, not my first Schmodio. A segment in it is where I get the guest to share a schmoment with me at a time that they've like deeply embarrassed themselves in public. Uh-huh. So this is a schmoment, but you tried so hard, and it's almost like a triumph because they didn't pull the curtain, they kept going. So good for you.
I would argue it's because no one in the audience is familiar enough or cared enough about Waiting for Godot to be like, this isn't the lines.
Well, I think it's the triumphant schmoment.
Thank you. Where does the word schmoment come from? What's the schmo part?
A schmo moment. So it's a schmo, my definition is like a regular person / fool.
Oh, I see. Like Joe Schmo. Okay.
Yeah, Joe Schmo, or like you're a schmo, you're a fool. It's a Jewish term. So it's sort of like just celebrating embarrassing yourself in public because it's so average. That type of thing.
Love it.
All right. I just have one last question for you. And that is once again about relationships and connections. What in your own life with connections that you make with people, what do those relationships translate into your work? Like, how do you pull from it, and what's off limits, and what do you like to pull from?
That's interesting, because I found that I don't know that I'm writing something that's personal until like 3 years after the thing is out. And then I'm like, oh, it was about my divorce. And all my friends are like, are you kidding? Of course it was. But I think I've always I just have a sort of, I don't know, you're drawn to what you're drawn to. And I think especially in the indie film world, you have to have a personal connection to that thing, or at least that it has to be self-generating, that drive to express a certain thing. That has to come from within, because you're not real. I don't know how people do it any other way, when they like, you know, just hop onto a franchise, or when they step in for a director that drops out last minute or something like that. I have a feeling I would have a much easier time being a really wealthy director or something if I knew how to do that, but I don't. So it's all just, it has to have some personal, you know, import. And usually that means it's a real relationship that you had or someone you knew. One of my favorite things about working with writers and either in writer's room or with like Nick, for example, my collaboration with him and Jenny, is that you're constantly kind of sharing parts of yourself or moments from your past. Because you'll say, you know, like, oh, well, how, you know, like, how does it manifest? How do you know when someone's controlling, or where does that manifest in their life? And then, you know, we're all kind of sitting around being like, oh, I knew this kid once at blah, blah, blah. Or my mom is like, did this thing, weird thing once. And I love that you sort of like, you get to be on a safari with your friends, looking at like the crazy sights of in their pasts or whatever. And that has always been, that's always really rewarding, especially when you can, like with Marcel, I think we all sort of felt like Marcel's so much about grief and loss and how it's the fertile soil that new growth sprouts from. I think we all sort of lent the story parts of ourselves, and that was very sort of rehabilitative in some ways. Because I mean, there's almost, we worked on it for so long, and everyone was so close to it that I don't think anyone who worked on it hadn't gone through some kind of heartbreak or loss or grieving process during the making of it.
Wow, that's a great answer. Thank you so much. I think that's also a great part of being a writer, is you sort of have a reason for your pain a little bit. Like you have, you can do something with your pain. You can do something
that's
with
true.
Your pain. Yeah,
you also have to be careful that you're not like prematurely using it for a creative project as a way of sticking your head in the sand, like as a way to not process it or to pretend you have narrative control over it. But I think, yeah, you're totally right. And I think, you know, probably all of our famous artists are lending pieces of themselves to their work.
Yeah, I think that's just how great art comes to be. Like Marcel, the show, Susan, which you direct and write.
You're and so good at that. Those segues are seamless.
If you want to have more of Dean, who has a mug that says his name on it.
I do.
Good for you. If you want more of Dean, then you can join the Vith Connect talk on October 7th between 1 and 2 p.m. Thank you so much for your time, Dean. It was so lovely meeting you. You're very lovely. That the Kool-Aid of yourself has not gone to your head, to use your words. And Sam,
thank you so much, Ruby.
Your assistant is also so lovely.
Thanks, Ruby. Thanks for your time, and thanks for all your great questions. It's lovely talking.
Thank you so much. Have a great afternoon. Bye.
Bye.
Wow. Wow. It's me, Ruby, in the present moment. I'm back. Wasn't that just so lovely? Dean Fleischer Camp, he is the writer-director of Marcel, the Shell with Shoes On. He's currently nominated for an Oscar for Best Animated Feature. You can watch Marcel, the Shell with Shoes on Amazon Prime Video, Apple TV, or any other on-demand services. It's a really cool film. If you're sick of the same old, Marcel, the Shell with Shoes On is definitely not that. And rooting for him. Hope he wins the Oscar. Again, I'm just going to remind listeners that this week is Fun Drive. Although it did technically end yesterday, we're still taking donations. We're trying to raise $20,000 for a new radio transmitter because ours is old. And there are actually some really cool prizes that you can win, some CITR swag, as we like to say around the station, for pledging a certain amount of money. So $30, you get a custom CITR lighter. $60, you get a custom CITR wine glass and the lighter. 101.9, because that's our FM station. $101.9, you get a Discorder embossed hardcover notebook. Don't we all love journaling? Plus a song dedication. And all the items listed above. For $500, you get a monogrammed bathrobe and all the above items. But come on, a monogrammed bathrobe? That's so cool. Really, really cool. And then for $1,000, you can host your own show and get a Fanta Records prize pack and all of the above items. So, you know, donating is, you don't just have to donate out of the benevolence of your heart. Like, you can donate to get all the really cool material goods that we're offering. You can go to citr.ca/donate to still donate. Please, we need a new radio transmitter. It's integral to the transmission of radio. Okay, next up, I have an interview with Baron Vaughn. Like I said, the reason why this connects to my Oscar theme, he worked with my favorite person ever to win an Oscar, Jane Fonda. As you hear in the interview, I come off as crazy, a crazed Jane Fonda fan. You'll hear the surprise in his voice as I describe my love for her. Okay, so Baron Vaughn will be performing on February 17th at the Biltmore Cabaret in Vancouver as a part of the Just for Laughs Vancouver Comedy Festival. So, Baron Vaughn, best known as Bud in Netflix's hit series Grace and Frankie, Baron Vaughn has been a comedian his entire life. He's been featured on Two Dope Queens, Conan, and co-created The Two New Negroes with Baron Vaughn and Open Mike Eagle for Comedy Central. You can also hear his silky voice as Tom Servo in Mystery Science Theater 3000. All right, so here's my interview with Baron. Remember, you can go see him live February the 17th at the Biltmore in Vancouver. All right, here is Baron Vaughn.
All right. So, Baron, before we get started, I do need to say that I'm like a huge fan of Grace and Frankie. Like I'm one of those people who is a fan of yours.
nothing wrong with that.
I've rewatched it a million times. And you know, when you rewatch things because you know the plot line or sometimes you know the lines, you can like really mine for things that you've never noticed before.
Yeah.
And this past rewatch, I have really noticed like how many dimensions your character has. You're like a really, really interesting character to watch. You play Bud Bergstein, Lily Tomlin's son. And I just really like your performance because you like your character is so clearly loving and so clearly loves being the person that is there for his whole family. But you see like you see his warmth, but the like depth of his warmth. And also he's just like seems like a fun person to be around.
Wow, Ruby, that's insanely very nice. Insanely very nice. I'm really good with words. That's very nice of you to say. I really appreciate that. Not only have you watched the show, but multiple times. Yeah. And that fortunately my performance has something to come back to make you go, yeah. Oh, wait a minute, that guy, he's interesting.
Exactly. You have this way of like curving language and also like small physical comedy that I really like. But
oh, thanks. Yeah, I mean, like that is the essence of Bud. You know what I mean? Is that he is sort of the emotional center for his family. You know, I think that he takes on too much a lot of the time, but that's also part of his personality is to kind of, he's like a fixer. You know what I mean? So that's what I really tried to endow him with, is that, like, he's constantly worried about everyone else but himself.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. So when I was watching you for the first time, I'm a huge comedy nerd. Like I follow all the like UCB, Second City, Groundlings people. So did you start at one of those places? Cause you had real improviser energy.
First of all, I don't know what real improviser energy is. Even though I definitely have it. I did not, I have trained in improv, but I didn't specifically train at the UCB or the Groundlings. But because of my style, you know, of stand-up is a bit, it's improvisational, you know, I like to hope that it feels like anything can happen, you know, like an improv show. So that's a big thing that I try to bring to the table in performing at a lot of those improv places, especially the UCB in New York and Los Angeles are very supportive of the stand-up scene. Mm-hmm. So then there's a lot of people who sort of do both, you know, they're improviser sketch people and they're stand-up, so they have a lot of shows. So there's always just kind of like that comedy energy coming in. But I definitely took a little of that improv feel, you know, to try to put it on my stand-up.
Mm-hmm. So if you're sort of like an improvisational stand-up, where would you put your comedy like in the landscape of comedy? If that question makes sense.
Wow, where would I put my comedy in the landscape of comedy? Yeah, I mean, it's a hard question. I think it's the question that the average comedian asks themselves all the time when we're working on our act, when we're going on the road, when we're performing, is where do I want to belong? You know, what is it that I want to put out there? Who is it that's doing anything that's similar to me? Or, you know, wow, I really don't see anybody doing what I'm doing out there. That's kind of what everybody, I think every comedian, like, that's the challenge that makes us like continue to grow, hopefully. And so for myself, you know, I liken myself in a sense to like jazz, in the sense that I don't stand up there and just do straight up jokes, you know, like devoid of any personality. That is a possibility if I need it. You know what I mean? Because I like to not only play with the words, but I really like to play with the emotions of whomever is telling the story, which could be me or any character that I'm inside of, you know, like the depressed pigeon isn't, or something like that. So that way you sort of always feel that everything around you is alive. Mm-hmm. Which is how I think of things. It's also called a personality disorder. Everything mm-hmm. around me is alive. And so, yeah, I put myself in the landscape of the kind of comedian. Like, there are the kind of comedians that are like, come off as if they know everything, or they are some sort of, you know, I've been told I've had a professorial style. Like, I sometimes seem like I'm a professor.
Like you're lecturing?
Like I'm lecturing, but I feel like that can't be right. I hope it's not right, because I jump in and out of all these different characters and voices and stuff like that. So, you know, I'm very much like an very animated. I'm an animated comedian. I like to talk about all kinds of things with multiple layers. So everything, you know, like there's always, I would like to believe, an extra layer besides the joke, besides the way I'm performing it, that there's something else going on as well. I try to put that. An onion. That's the kind of comedian I am. Just a lot of layers.
Right. A lot of layers. And so if we're peeling back the onion of you as a comedian, what layer of you is an actor? How did you get cast in Grace and Frankie?
Oh, well, that's interesting. I mean, I think every comedian is an actor. We're just playing a version of ourselves. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of comedians are not aware of this, which is where they sometimes get in trouble. But, you know, the person that we're bringing on stage is a couple of aspects of our personality mm-hmm. that come out. And with acting, it's a similar thing. Like, I get to figure out whatever character I'm playing, like what parts of that person are similar to me, you know, mm-hmm. which parts of myself I want to bring out, I want to accentuate to make this person make sense. And I think that like my curiosity about everyone's emotional intentions, you know, comes from theater school, comes from like my acting training, is that this idea that everyone has an intention, trying to get something, and either you get it or you don't. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And that's going to affect who you are, who your day is. Mm-hmm. So that's the commonality between stand-up and acting. Is with acting, I'm playing a character who wants something. In stand-up, I get to ask about everyone around me. Mm-hmm. You know, whether it be the some lady I saw on the street, whether it be the political machine at large, mm-hmm. you know, I'm trying to guess at what their intentions are, and then also reveal how much or how little I know mm-hmm. about those things at the same time.
So when you talk about bringing yourself to characters, rather, you know, whether it's on stage or as an actor, what parts of you are in the character of Bud?
Well, definitely the part of me that is an excessive worry wart, part of me that is very concerned, that is constantly like, I think the word is catastrophizing.
Oh, yes.
So Bud is at all times catastrophizing, trying to think through what could go wrong here. You know, if my mom or my brother or my wife do X, Y, and Z, somehow it's all going to come back to bite me in the butt. And I'm trying to like save my own butt mm-hmm. in a lot of ways by saving everybody else. So there is a bit of that constant fixer type A personality, the type A personality part of myself that I let shine through with Bud.
And I have to ask, because I'm literally obsessed with Jane Fonda. Like, I've seen the documentary about her life, I'm not kidding, 12 times.
Whoa.
I hosted a screening at my house so that my friends would watch it. So what was it like working with her and Lily Tomlin?
Well, I mean, and not only an honor, but a heck of a confidence boost.
Really?
Oh, yeah, because, you know, any actor, our biggest worry, because even if we get a role, you know, and I got Grace and Frankie the old-fashioned way, like I auditioned, had multiple callbacks, and then I was the guy that they wanted, so I was really happy. But, you know, when you are going to act with people who are at a certain level, you know, a certain notoriety, a certain fame, a certain skill, maybe they have multiple Oscars, you know, stuff like that. There's an intimidation factor. So it's like, it's really easy to let that sort of run you. But the thing about the camera is that the camera like gets everything. So if I'm like super intimidated, so if I'm like super intimidated on camera, like it reads. So being able to hold my own with Jane, with Lily, and really connect with them is a confidence boost. It's and to know that none of them complained, you know, they weren't like, this guy is just, where did you find him? He wasn't professional. He wasn't on time. He wasn't blah, 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 or whatever the crap. I'm never on time, but that's beside the point. I still bring the skills. So luckily, and Jane and Lily are both really cool, warm people, especially on the set. You know, they both believe in, as far as I understand, rising tide raises all ships. You know, that like, it's a back and forth. And, you know, when one of the things that Jane Fonda, look, it's very common that on sets, sometimes there'll be like a really, really famous actor who, once their footage is over, once they've shot everything that they're on camera, you know, you turn around and you shoot the other person that's in the scene. It's a conversation. Famous people, especially if they're older, especially if it's after midnight, have every right, as far as I'm concerned, to leave. You know, you've already done your part. I'll act to a chair.
Yeah.
Jane never left. Jane was always there for me, which I take as like to know that she treated me with respect, you know, and that it's almost as if she modeled how to respect somebody else. And I was able to follow that model. She would sit in the chair off camera and be a person for me to act against, to be the eyes and the face in the scene, you know, so that way I had something to work with, because she knows that it'll make me look really good. It'll make her look really good. So I always will remember that people who are lesser experienced, lesser decorated, lesser, you know, and sometimes even more lauded, won't do the decent, simple thing that Jane Fonda did for me. It's just like, be there when, like, after midnight, so I can have somebody to like act off of.
That's exactly what I wanted to hear. It's like, yes, perfect. Do you have any, like, as like a major fan of the show, do you have any like funny stories from on set or anything that like insider knowledge that I can feel cool hearing about?
That's a hard one. I mean, it was always fun being on set, especially because Jane, Lily, Sam Waterston, and Martin Sheen have all been on sets before cell phones were invented.
Right.
So when it's in between scenes, instead of the majority of us, and I'll admit that I was one of those people as well, you know, it's like, oh, it's not time to do anything. Let me look at my phone. Let me see what the heck is, you know, going on. They would talk to each other. You know, they would like tell stories and talk about politics and, you know, talk about their kids and what's happening and just the world, you know? And so it was just, my favorite thing was watching them just be with each other all the time. You know, I wish that there was some kind of story of scandal or something, but it was a relatively mild set, you know? We had a really fun time.
That's awesome. Yay, that's exactly what I wanted to hear. This is perfect. You're making all my dreams come true. Thank you.
Great.
I just have one final question, which is you are performing at the Biltmore Cabaret on February 17th as a part of the Just for Laughs Comedy Festival here in beautiful Vancouver. So what can people expect from your show?
Why should people
go to your show?
Oh, okay. Well, if you like to experience humans, <I do. laughs> if you, I'm going to be talking about all kinds of things, you know, there's a lot of things that are happening in my life, whether they be personal or universal. I mean, I'm going to talk about COVID and the fact that we just all are living with it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the pandemic has endemicked, I guess. Mm-hmm. I am a parent, but I'm also a parent who grew up without my own father. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to put those two things together, like what it means to be a father when I wasn't fathered, you know, at the same time, and how much it brings up. I kind of refer to myself sometimes as a kitchen sink comedian, in the sense that I throw everything at you, including the kitchen sink. So I always try to have some sort of, like, when I describe my act, it doesn't sound funny. Because I like to talk about real. I'm going to talk about COVID. I'm going to talk about depression. I'm going to talk about cats, especially ones who are not a fan of me. stuff like that. But it always sounds like not funny. But the funny comes in the moment. The funny comes in the how I was able to twist it or to surprise you, the audience. So I think that anyone that comes will experience something that they won't forget. Mm-hmm. You'll always remember me no matter what happens.
I believe that. I really believe that. All right. Well, Baron, thank you so much for coming on the Zoom call with me today and talking to me. All right. Bye, Baron. Have a great day.
Bye-bye.
Wow. And we're back to the present moment. Wasn't Baron Vaughn just so nice, so funny? I cannot wait to go see his show at the Biltmore Cabaret in Vancouver on February 17th. Okay, once again, I'm going to remind the listeners that it is Fun Drive. Technically, it ended yesterday, but we're still taking donations. We're trying to raise money for a new radio transmitter. I love CITR so much, and you can trust that I have great taste. So if I love it, like, you're probably going to, you know, feel that way too. So if you have any spare change, donating to the arts in the city is always really great. Anyone who wants can have a show here. If you're interested in writing for the magazine, you can just go pitch them. We want everything to be as accessible as possible. And we're a really unique place like that in the city. So please, we need a radio transmitter. Okay, now we are at the final segment of the show, of the first episode of the second season during Fun Drive Week of Not My First Schmodio that is Oscar themed. Best Oscar. No, wait. Oscar for Best Schmoment goes to, as we would say in 2014, the man, the myth, the legend, but it's 2023, so I'm not going to say that. Uncle Jake. Uncle Jake has shared with this Schmoment with me, and I feel like it deserves Best Schmoment, not because, you know, it is the most wild ride of his life, but because of how kind of normal it is, how it really could happen to anyone, but it still has that element of shock and that element of, oh no, oh no. And I think I'm going to start sharing some more Schmoments from people that I come across, because I really do hear some relatable ones, and I am just trying to bring together and celebrate a humanity of schmoes. And that's what I think Uncle Jake and I did when he shared this moment with me. Okay, take it away, Uncle Jake.
Amazing. Thank you so much for joining me today, Uncle Jake.
You're welcome.
So this is a very special episode of Not My First Schmodio. It's the first episode of the second season. And it's also during our fundraising week called Fun Drive. So we're trying to raise money, and people do like special episodes of their shows. So mine is Oscar themed, because I just needed a special episode, and I have an interview with an Oscar nominee that I haven't aired yet. So I'm going to air that. I'm interviewing an actor who's worked with Jane Fonda, and Jane Fonda is my favorite person ever who's won an Oscar, so that makes sense. And then this is me awarding you best schmoment, the Oscar for best schmoment. Because I've, you know, in explaining the concept of my show to people, they often share schmoments with me. And yours has been really one of my favorites that I've heard, because it's so normal that it just really hits the spot of what a schmoment is. So I'm wondering if you can please tell me again your schmoment that you shared with me many months ago.
Well, first of all, I really like your title, Schmoment. It made me laugh. And I think it does sum it up. But okay, so what happened was I had obtained a job in Bulgaria, teaching at the American University of Bulgaria. And it was my first real teaching job as a university professor. And I arrived there and I had to teach on the first day of classes. So it was the very first day. It was very hot because, you know, school there started in end of August. And in the town we were in, it's very, very hot. So it's like 38 degrees. So people just wear T-shirts and shorts, even when they're teaching at the university. So I was just wearing T-shirt and shorts. And my class came in and I handed out the syllabus.
So this
and
is
started
this
to explain this, everything. And I was quite nervous because
this is your first time teaching ever and the first class you're teaching ever.
Well, it wasn't my first time. I taught prior to this in Central Asia for a year, but it was my first time teaching in this institution ever. And the first day of teaching in this place ever. And so I, you know, even though I taught for a year, I was still nervous because it's a new institution, a new class, and teaching, you're always a bit nervous when you first start out. So anyway, the windows of the classroom were open because it was so hot. And a bee or a wasp, I still don't know to this day, came in and was buzzing around. And I tried to ignore it. And then all of a sudden, it flew at me and flew up the bottom of my shirt onto my skin. And I was I hate bees. I'm sure a lot of people do, but you know, I hated it. So I freaked out in front of the classroom and I started to jump around and wave my shirt up and down to get it off me, off my chest. And it wouldn't come off. It was just sitting there. So as I'm running around the classroom, leaping up and down, I had to pull my shirt off entirely and then take the shirt and, you know, try to rub this thing off of me as I was jumping around the classroom. And the kids in the classroom were just shocked by this. Like, who is this guy? And it was extremely awkward. And then once this thing left me, I guess it flew out the window. Anyway, I had to put the shirt back on and just continue class like nothing had happened. And everybody was trying to, like, break out laughing, and they were all smirking, and it was just very funny. But what's funny is that after about 5 minutes, fine again. Like, I think it was just like no problem. But for those few minutes, I was very, very. It was very funny. But I, for some reason, I wasn't even that embarrassed. I don't know. I think it was because it was so normal. And what are you going to do when you got a bee or a wasp flying up into your body? Like, what are you gonna do?
So, this is why this is my one of my favorite schmoments, is because it's so normal. Like, it could happen to anyone. Like, so many people are afraid of bees, and you're just what can you do but like just rip your shirt off in front of all your students because you're so in the middle of your terror that you can't even, like, it doesn't matter what's going on around you, you just can't get stung by this bee.
Yeah, it was funny, but I think it was good because I think it broke the ice with the students. Clearly it would have. And then they just, you know, it was like they weren't nervous around me anymore because this was so ridiculous what happened that it just broke the ice. So I think it established a good rapport with me and the students, which was great.
Because embarrassing yourself like that in front of a large group of people, everyone has this understanding that that's a deeply embarrassing thing, but it also humanizes the person. So it really brought everyone together as a humanity of schmoes, wouldn't you say?
Yeah. And I would say that if they were nervous about me, they could see that, like, here's a guy who's going to do that, then, you know, not too intimidating, really, for them. So, yeah, that worked out well. But it was very funny at the time and just, like, a weird thing to have that on the very first day and when you're trying to make a good impression, and that just a weird occurrence. But, yeah, very funny.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Uncle Jake, for sharing this schmoment. Amazing.
Wow. Wow. Wasn't that just a schmoment? That is embarrassing. Stripping off your shirt because you're afraid of a bee in front of your first lecture at a new university because you're afraid of a bee. Truly hilarious. Really, really funny stuff. That brings us to the end of this episode. Stay tuned for next week and the week after. It will be Just for Laughs content with a ton of comedians who are performing in Vancouver. And you can get a taste of which shows you might want to go see and which comedians are up your alley. Again, it is Fun Drive. We are trying to raise $20,000 for a new radio transmitter. So if you would like to use the kindness in your heart and donate so we can have a new radio transmitter, that would be so lovely. But yeah, okay, well, thank you so much. Enjoy the rest of your Friday. I hope that you have a wonderful day. I hope that you eat something that's really delicious, like maybe you have like a really like moist piece of chocolate chip banana bread, or like just some warm pita and hummus, or maybe like a fun salad. And that feels good. All right. Have a great Friday. Bye. Must be funny in the rich man's world. Money talks. Money talks. Dirty cash, I want you. Dirty cash, I need you all. Money talks. Oh, no. Money talks. Dirty cash, I want you. Dirty cash, I need you all. I'm DJ Wah, the host of Techno Progressivo on 101.9 CITR. I did my first episode in 2010 and celebrated the 11th anniversary just this past October. I appreciate that over this time, the station has given me an avenue to share a selection of house and techno with you every second Sunday. Over this past year, I've served up a full slate of DJ and producer interviews as well as guest mixes. Because of CITR's programming mandate, I can offer to you the show I want to deliver. CITR's annual Fun Drive event is a great opportunity for listeners to share their support with CITR to allow myself and all the other programmers to